and welcome to another episode of the Send Mum Club podcast. I'm going to be honest with you, I don't know when this episode will be going out, but I can tell you in real life, the kids have gone back to school this week. So if your kids are back, then I hope it's gone well. If your kids are starting, I hope it's gone well. I hope you are enjoying a little bit more time to yourself or a little bit less things to do, a little less money to spend. My God, even the last day of the school holidays, just one day, cost me an absolute bloody fortune. I kind of do miss them already, though. Double-edged sword, isn't it? Anyway, if you haven't listened to this podcast before, the Send Mum Club is the parenting podcast with a difference. And the difference being, of course, that it is all about children with SEN, or being parents of children with SEN, should I say. If you haven't listened before, the reason for starting this podcast is because my little boy Leo, who is two, nearly three, makes me want to cry because he's my last. Want it all slow down, please. Anyway, he has Down syndrome. So that's my experience as a SEND mum. And I kind of wanted to create a place to share experiences and thoughts and feelings with other mums. And do you know what I love so much is that I have learned so much. I've spoken to some amazing women on this podcast so far since it started earlier on in the year. And I have another one for you today. My guest is Laura Wallace. Now, she is here to talk about her son, Ted, who has cerebral palsy. Now, obviously, I have heard that word. I know a couple of people vaguely who have cerebral palsy, but I will be honest with you. Until I had this chat with Laura, I don't think I knew exactly what that meant. I kind of knew how it could present and the challenges, or some of the challenges that it could bring up. But it was good to get a bit more of a deep dive into exactly what cerebral palsy is. And again, there's that education thing coming up where I'm learning so much. So me and Laura had a really emotional chat, actually, at points. We talked about feelings of guilt after you get a diagnosis. I think lots of us have probably been there with that one. We also talk about loneliness and how hard she found that. Again, something so relatable as a SEND mum. Well, in fact, as a mum in general, especially a first-time mum, as Laura was at the time. So yeah, we talk about all of that. We talk about how she ended up finding support. We talk about comparison and just the general day-to-day challenges that come up due to Ted's cerebral palsy. So enough from me, let's get into it. Laura, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you're one of my favourite type of guests because you slid into my DMs, and I'm always saying this on the episodes, like, slide into my DMs, I'd love that. So when people actually do, I'm like, yes, this is great.
I know, I felt very brave doing it, but it was just, I'd loved the podcast, I think that's it. And every episode that I've listened to has been so just very, very comforting, in a really supportive way. I've shared it with people I know, so I couldn't help it.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. Thank you so much. Now, Laura, you have got two children, haven't you? Ted and Annabelle. Annabelle is two. How old's Ted?
Four.
And he has just started reception, has he, this week?
That's right. Yeah, we're on day two.
That's like a big thing. How's he? How are you?
It's been tough. I think mainly it's the build up. I think a lot of he's used to nursery, so it's not too bad. But we've probably built it up more than we should over the holidays and made it quite a big thing. And he's been very brave, but I think for us, it's a bigger jump, isn't it? So he's. You know, a bit teary, but he's managed to get into school and he's doing well. And the teachers have been really supportive, which is amazing. But there is obviously, at the back of our mind, it's been a bit like, oh God, this is the start of school. This is the academic stuff. How is he going to manage?
I feel like there's that emotional side as well, though, like seeing your first child in their uniform that's normally a teeny tiny bit too big for them with like the coat and the bag. And you're like, oh.
We've had the whole photo shoot. Yeah. He loved the photos. It's the school he wasn't like.
Oh, I mean, to be fair, I'd be the same. Here for the photos, not for the work.
Yeah. But he couldn't have been braver. It's been really good. And we're only on day two. So, you know, but the staff have been amazing. And again, it's all transition. So things like social stories have sent through and home visits and things, have done everything they possibly could. We've just got to keep going and just make sure he's aware it's routine now. Yeah.
Yeah, I think sometimes they think like they do a week and then go, great, I'm done now. And you're like, no, you're staying forever.
That's it, yeah.
So tell me about Ted, because it is Ted that we're here to chat about.
So Ted, he's 4, as you said. He's going to be 5 in November. And we've had, a bit of a roller coaster with him, but he is hilarious. He keeps us on our toes. He's very particular. He likes his certain things. He's kind of, sometimes you would say he's really typical, and he loves his Marvel characters and he's into his certain things that he loves. And on the other hand, he's just very, very unique, and you never quite know what's coming out of his mouth at different times. But he's hilarious. He's fantastic. Yeah, we absolutely love him.
Now, Ted has cerebral palsy, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Could we start by just, for anybody that doesn't know, I would say probably I have a general knowledge of what that is, but for anybody who would need a little bit more info, can you just explain exactly what that is and what it means?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head that it is a really difficult condition to describe. I think that's part of the issue that we both had as parents, is you hear that, that label, and you suddenly think, what does that mean? And what's that going to mean for him? Yeah. So Ted has, it's a brain injury that was caused, and again, they're not certain, but they think it was caused at the end of birth or maybe during birth through a stroke. What the issue with is that sometimes the amount of injury that's on the brain is not really related to what you sometimes see. So they didn't actually show us an MRI at the time because they said we almost wouldn't want you to see it because you might think the worst. So some children are affected more by the same amount of brain injury, if that makes sense. But Ted has a little bit of effect on both sides of the brain, but it's mainly his left side of his body, his right side of his brain that's affected. So it's called left hemiplegia, and there's different types of cerebral palsy. So quadriplegia is where all of your arms and legs are all affected, and then hemiplegia is where one side of the body is more than the other. So it's a little bit, and it presents rather like a stroke with Ted. So it's a little bit different to, again, you might visualise lots of different things, and especially if you Google cerebral palsy, you get a completely different range of symptoms, because it can affect the body in so many different ways. Additionally, as well, there's a lot of comorbid conditions that come with it. So with a brain injury, you might then see there's a massive amount of children then are suffering with autism, for example, or neurodiversity. Epilepsy is another major condition that can come kind of hand in hand with cerebral palsy. So again, there's a massive range, but at the minute, Ted presents with it a little bit more like a stroke. His left side of his body is weaker.
And if we could just go back to the beginning, how long did it take you to find that out? Is it something that takes a while to kind of present itself?
Yeah, so I think, again, this is probably one of the hardest parts for us as parents, again, because you are kind of, you're obviously clueless. I think particularly most parents, I may be generalising, but a lot of parents understand that their child might have a brain injury or might have suffered from this during perhaps a premature birth. So a lot of the time they're a bit more kind of clued up once the baby is born. The baby might have been born at 28, 30 weeks, and they're told there's a high likelihood that this has happened. Whereas with us, there was just absolutely no sign whatsoever. He had a really natural birth. It was a water birth. It was amazing. And everything was just going so smoothly. There wasn't any symptom really during pregnancy. It was a lockdown period, so I had less appointments, you might say, but there was nothing for me that would flag up any issues. Just nothing at all. So really, you're basing it on just an inkling then eventually, thinking something just doesn't seem right. So timeline-wise, it wasn't till he was about 18 months and we still thought, he's not walking and he's not doing, not hitting some of his main milestones, but he's such a bright boy. It was really hard to convince professionals and to get kind of support around that, because people would at first say, oh, he's just a bit lazy, don't worry. Health visitors in the best way were saying, oh, he's a bright boy, he's doing this, he's doing that, it'll be fine. And it's only now when you look back at photos, there's some obvious signs of it, but only obviously once we knew what we were looking for. Would we have noticed that? So that was really tough, because there was something just that I thought, there's something not right. I just knew it. But of course, you're a first time mum, so you've got nothing to compare it to. You're in lockdown, so you're not really, you know, you're not going to your standard baby groups. And I was dead keen to go to the baby groups and sign up for everything. But a lot of the time, we had an amazing NCT group. And, you know, we would meet, but we would have the babies in prams and we would be walking and trying to, you know, kind of help our own mental health and socialise. But baby-wise, you didn't have that much time where, you know, they were side by side on a mat, for example, and things like that. So it was only when that started a bit more and the other children I noticed were sitting up and they were moving around, and it just eventually, the more people had kind of said, I'm sure it's fine. And the GP had said, I think maybe, you know, there might be some, he'd said something to do with maybe a foot abnormality. And he said, I'm not sure. But it was the nursery assistant that said, I think she'd seen it before. And she didn't say that at the time, but she said, we noticed he started to knee walk. So he kind of wanted to move around, but he just couldn't get on his feet. Mm. And she said, I really would push you to go and see, you know, go and see a professional. She said, I really do think there's something more to this. You could just do with it being investigated. And from there, then, thank God, people started to listen, and he went through with an MRI quite quickly, because I think it just took one person to go, no. And have you noticed that he clenched his left fist at that time a bit more, obviously, because he was starting to feed himself. So things just started to build up. But it took a long time. Yeah, it did take a long time to kind of finally get the MRI. And from then, very quickly, we were told that that's what they'd found. But the shock, obviously, of that was just devastating. Yeah, devastating.
So how old was he when you actually got the diagnosis?
So he was 20 months when we got the diagnosis officially. And again, they were very supportive. But you are kind of, if I can be honest, you're in complete denial, because you're being told this horrendous news. But at the same time, he seemed to us absolutely fine. You know, from that other point of view, you can't really visualise that this child has something so extreme wrong with him, because, I mean, I remember she'd written this in the report, outside the doctor's office, he's pointing and shouting at the buses going past, and just quite typical, to be honest, very typical. And we'd already kind of started quite a lot of things in process. So, for example, he was already getting some orthotic boots to support his feet before we got the diagnosis, because we didn't know it was so extreme. And so really, a lot of the time, she was kind of saying, you're doing everything really that we would do at this age anyway, you know, kind of just keep it up and we will, you know. And she did say, I remember her saying, you'll be part of a big team and this team will be wrapped around you. And I remember thinking, why? You know, weirdly, I just felt a bit like, and everyone at that point was, oh, I'm so sorry. And, you know, you really felt like something devastating had happened, but then he was completely typical, and you couldn't really compute how that diagnosis then met him. It just felt totally different, and just, we were both completely in shock, and I think we were both completely in denial as well as to what that would look like. I think I went one way and my husband went the other way. My husband was totally in denial and said, it'll be absolutely fine. And I went, I think then from that to, oh my God, what's this going to mean? We're not going to, you know, he's going to be wheelchair bound. I just completely went to the other extreme of cerebral palsy as well. So yeah, it was a long process, a lot of worrying and a lot of waiting in between. And a lot of, I was just desperate for them to say that you're overreacting and you've got, you know, you're dramatising all of these things. And she, I just remember her line vividly. She just said, and you're absolutely right. And, you know, he does have this brain injury. And I just thought, oh my God, that's the only time that you just want to be really wrong about something. So
it's hard thinking back. You've got me now. It's hard thinking back to that moment, isn't it, of sitting in that room and them giving you that diagnosis that you're desperate not to hear.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember just, we walked out when we both just, I took some deep breaths, and you just have to think, right, you know, what's next? And we went through, it was a few weeks, really dark few weeks of, Yeah, just what does this mean? What does this mean for us? And what does it mean for Ted? And I think there's a lot of, as a parent, there's a lot of things you don't expect, but you really don't expect that. You know, you do think that you're going to have shocking times. You're going to have things that, you know, things that will surprise you, I'm sure. But you really do think, why us? Why has this happened? And I went through a really dark period of just guilt. Guilt because I couldn't explain why it had happened. And I think I could only describe it to my husband because he kept trying to protect me in that sense and, you know, support me. But I could only describe it as if we'd been in an accident and I'd been driving the car. And I said, there's kind of a guilt there that even though it's not your fault, you were driving, you know. And it kind of still comes up now, to be honest. And I talk about this quite a lot with friends and family, but it comes up now, you know, about whether any drug or alcohol use during pregnancy and what happened during pregnancy and was there any obvious sign. And I think, thank God, sometimes that we were in lockdown because my husband was with me every single minute of the day. We didn't leave the house. We didn't do anything. So part of me, that, you know, he really supported me and has often stepped in and said, absolutely not, you know, there was no obvious sign. But those questions get to you, don't they? And you do think, well, what did I do? Have I done something? You know, it was a really tough time.
I mean, that's hard. If you're feeling those feelings of guilt anyway, the inference with those questions is, well, did you do anything to make this happen, isn't it?
Yeah.
I find that quite wild that you're being asked things like that.
Oh, yeah. And even recently, so when, I mean, it's been a bit more unique for us because we've moved areas. So we've had to go through the whole process again, which I've found really difficult. So we've had to explain things again to a lot of professionals. But even then, you're still asked all those questions. And I do understand that, you know, you can't judge a person by the cover, can you? You have to ask those questions just for the benefit of understanding the family history. But again, as you said, the inference is really hard. And I suppose when you're already feeling guilty and you're already feeling vulnerable, that's when that really gets to you. Even things like, I suppose, from my point of view, the guilt of, should I have acted on something? Did I notice something? And I don't remember anything. But you just replay every single moment and when it could have happened. And the water birth, for example, I often think, was that, you know, a mistake? Did we do the wrong thing? But at the time, it was amazing. And we were like being championed and they were all saying how amazingly we'd done. I didn't even have pain relief. You know, I literally had paracetamol and gas and air. And I was, you know, bigging myself up thinking, hey, you know, I've managed to do this. I can't believe it. And it wasn't pain free, but it was an amazing delivery compared to my second. Now I know I can compare. And my second was very much interfered with and, you know, it was an induction and it was very unnatural. And it was horrendous, you know, pain-wise. And I just think, God, in comparison, it's unbelievable that's happened in that scenario. And again, you know, difficult to identify with other people that have gone through it because, you know, I desperately kind of clawed at, like, you know, who do I know that maybe has gone through this? And I even, you know, as like desperately as it sounds, I joined a charity essentially that was run for parents and families of children who have been on the ICU. I kind of begged them to let me join, and she obviously felt sorry for me, bless her, and she was amazing, felt sorry for me for being in this situation and said, of course, you know, we'll connect you with families, no problem. But I couldn't connect because none of them had really gone through what we'd gone through in the same scenario. They all were prepared. If anything, They'd been through hellish ordeals and very traumatic births and generally premature births, but they'd all been prepared for the worst, and that worst kind of might not have happened or it might have happened, but to us it just came as a complete sideways shock at 18 months old, with maybe I would say 6 months of just kind of I'm worried. So whereas they were so, I remember this particular woman in the park who met me and she was just amazing. She was just so, oh yes, I've done this and I've organised this and yeah, and I'm thinking of doing this for him. I'm getting this level of support. And I remember thinking, how are you so together? How have you got all this kind of planned out? How have you accepted it so quickly? How have you managed to be so positive? It was unbelievable because I just couldn't understand how she got her head around it. And she just looked at me and she went, but we knew before he was born. She said, you're just finding this out now. And I thought, yeah. And it was lovely because she said, I've got 2 years on you. I've already had 2 years to come to terms with this, to accept this. And I thought, yeah, that made me feel a lot better because I did think, why are we not doing the best for him? I mean, to be honest, I'm still not great at certain things. There's still certain things we're in denial of. I'm not great at. Yeah. I haven't applied for DLA, for example. I haven't done certain things because I've got a little bit of a fear of, you know, taking that step. But at the same time, I just think we've got to just do one thing at a time, and I can't do it all. And
no, and I think it's great to recognise that rather than going, I have to do this because we're entitled to it. I need to do it now. Like, you can do it whenever. And I will say, I don't know if you've listened to any of the episodes or we've talked about it. I found the DLA application really difficult. And I'm not talking about logistically and admin wise. And it is hard because it's a lot of paperwork. You have to get every report from every, you know, person that they're under. You have to get people to help write it. But emotionally, I found that incredibly difficult. So I understand possibly why you're putting that off, because I put it off for quite a long time and then sat down, bit the bullet and did it. And I would say I had some kind of mind breakdown afterwards. Really? And it took me about a week to kind of get myself back to, I don't know, I feel like I talk about how I feel a lot. But I think seeing everything written down in black and white on hospital letters, I found really difficult. Like, we've got a filing cabinet at home and each of the kids have got like a thing in it, you know, with their stuff in. So my older two, there's literally like, Alfie's 17 now, so it's got his like national insurance number in and a couple of letters. Millie's hasn't really got anything, and Leo's is like this thick from letters from older hay. And I think that it made it hit home a little bit for me. That
big one for us recently was the blue badge application, and again, for ages I'd felt like, he doesn't need it, he's absolutely fine, we don't need to do that, I don't want it to, us to literally to have a badge to say he is disabled, I don't want that. But I'm so glad I did, because it's just made the summer so much easier for him. It's meant that, you know, certain places that we go, yes, he's not absolutely exhausted by the time he gets to the entrance, because that's a big thing for Ted. He's shattered. You know, wherever we go, it's a lot of parents, and again, this is another converse thing that makes you feel a little bit lonely and a bit on your own there, is that we reserve energy. Whereas most parents try to run off energy and try to burn it and think, what can we do? Right, let's have the kids doing X, Y, and Z. And I'm always like, no, that's not going to work for us. We can do one activity in the morning, maybe. And then I need to factor in chill time for him, because that's what he needs. But it's tough as well, because he doesn't present like that. So often you feel a little bit, again, that you're, is it me? I sometimes sense that people are a bit like, oh, well, he'll be fine because he presents fine. So he might seem fine, but I know he needs that time. And there's only people that are really close to him that do see that energy drop, and they get it. His teacher said it today. She said, he is unbelievably tired. And she said, even maybe we should factor in an afternoon snack for him, something extra. And it's when you see it, you think, oh gosh, right, we've got to support him to make sure he gets the best out of whatever we're doing. Yeah, the blue badge was a big step, because I had to go and, again, explain ourselves. I had to go and have an assessment, and he had to look, and he said, well, he looks like he walks quite well. And I said, yeah. And then I had to explain it, and you sometimes just feel like you're being OTT, but it's really difficult when you just think, just believe me, this is how it is. But I understand everyone's got a job to do, but I felt like that was a big step for us, so maybe the DLA will come.
How do you feel, if you don't mind me asking, about that word disabled?
Yeah, it is difficult, isn't it? Because he does have a disability. And I think there's more to it than just the physical aspect of things. I think, again, he appears, because he's not in a wheelchair, for example, he appears like he's functioning quite well. So I think certain people associate disabled with, for example, a wheelchair. Yeah. And we've noticed lately that he's now wearing a leg splint, you see, on his left side. And we've noticed lately that there's a lot more kind of questions about that. And people maybe look, and I noticed one lady on holiday, she looked down and kind of looked away. And I think when there's something obvious that maybe shows someone is disabled, then you perhaps get a little bit, I don't know, not special treatment, but you get a little bit more free rein perhaps. But I do really feel for the families who have a disabled child, and I'm glad now with the blue badge, for example, that they have started to accommodate for autism. Have you seen that?
I haven't.
Yeah, so there's an element to it now where it says, I can't remember the word exactly, but it's a phrase around how they would be unsafe. Are they aware of their surroundings? And it's kind of looking at children that are the escape artists, essentially, the ones that do run off, and that can be really difficult for parents, can't it, who have those experiences. But it's not on the list, so they can't access that. So that's something that's improved, which is great. I do think there is a bit more awareness, but if I'm honest, I am also reluctant. I don't want him to have the sunflower lanyard, for example. I don't think he needs it, but am I doing him a disservice? Is it me who's worried about him being labelled disabled? I don't know. It's really difficult.
I know. I find that. I think it's hard to work out where it's coming from.
Yeah,
sometimes, yeah. Isn't it?
I know. It's a lot about me and my husband, I think, about how we're managing the scenario. So again, with the blue badge, I kind of took control and I said, this is why we're doing it. And he totally agreed. He said, yeah, you're right. But I think initially we do want him to be as typical as possible. And
of course.
I don't know why, though. So interestingly, I always go back to this. I spoke to somebody about it early on and I said, why do I feel like he has to fit in? Why is that in me? Because I don't know why it is. I'm not bothered. I think, you know, he's doing brilliantly. He is who he is. But there's a weird pull to be like, oh, I want him to just be able to get on with everyone. I just want him to be able to go to this mainstream school. I just want him to be able to go to a soft play and be fine. But I don't know where it comes from. And it was explained to me that it does come from this kind of innate feel from, you know, in historically as humans, we want them to be able to be part of the pack for survival. That is the whole point. They need to kind of fit in with the pack, and that will help them in their earlier stages. But he said, don't forget, did your mum and dad ever help you with, say, CV or trying to push you to get a job? And they will have encouraged you to stand out. And I remember my mum vividly drawing stars on my university application and being like, woo, you know, and trying to, yeah, make me be somebody else, but not somebody else, but, you know, make me the best I could possibly be and not fitting in and trying to stand out from the crowd. And so that kind of sits with me every time I wrestle with it. I think, yeah, I want him to be exactly who he is. And I think as a parent, there's a pull, but I try and go to that all the time and think, how am I going to decorate his CV? What am I going to say about him? It's not necessarily his disability, but it might be. It might be what he's learned and his resilience. And we went to soft play recently, and there's this massive volcano that they can climb up. And his two-year-old sister is whipping off her socks and figuring out how to do it. And she's getting up there straight away. And he couldn't do it. And he kept falling down. He kept getting about halfway and he kept falling down. And afterwards, I was like, but you're the only one who kept trying. I said, the rest of them might have done it. And then they were bored. I said, you have gone back and forth and you kept trying. And you were the most resilient, determined kid there today. So I'm trying to do it that way. I'm trying to sell it in that way because I think that's what he will be brilliant at.
I get that. I've had exactly the same feelings that you've just described about Leo. I think mine was centered centered around school. Like I had this thing where I was like, he has to go to mainstream school. Like, and I think that was kind of in my head was like a marker of everything's normal. It's not really affecting him that much. Everything's fine because he's in mainstream school. And I had to work through that. And, you know, he might go to mainstream school, but I've had to kind of spend some time in therapy working through where that was coming from. And I've now got to a place where I can go, well, I want him to go to the school that is the best setting for him to be in. Yes, deep down, I would love that if it was mainstream. I think that's a normal feeling to have. And I think I would like to think that, you know, nobody would listen to that and go, oh, you shouldn't be saying that. You know, it doesn't matter. Because I think, you know, it's, we got described to us as a preferred future.
Mm.
You have a preferred future that you visualize for your family and your child. And when that's taken away from you, it's hard. It's hard to let go of that.
Mm.
But yeah. I think the thing that I come back to, like, you've got the stars on your CV, which I love. I think that's a really lovely thing to go to. I think mine is the preferred future was never yours, because you could have, in your case, you would have a preferred future for Annabelle. And it might be that, I don't know, as an example, that you go horse riding together and that's your thing. And you've always imagined having a daughter that you're going to do these things with. And then she might hate that. So
I think on that note, though, I think the sibling has, oh my God, it's just completely, at the time I was pregnant when we got Ted's diagnosis, and I remember thinking, you know, just what have we done? Because it was kind of it was a lovely surprise pregnancy, but it wasn't planned. It wasn't something we planned, which was, you know, kind of part of the timing. And we got the diagnosis, and obviously the pregnancy for me was kind of clouded with, what if it happens again? What if I have got something that's causing this? But having her, almost in a way, a little bit like a rainbow baby, as a lot of people describe it, don't they? Obviously, if they've miscarried, but I think it was such a dark period, as you've described, as grief, really, of that, what we imagined. And then it's taught me that it absolutely makes no difference what you do. Your child is going to be exactly themselves. That's what it's taught me, that really, as you've said, I mean, she's just the opposite to what I thought it would be like. I imagined dressing, doing lovely little pigtails, and oh, it'd be so lovely to have a girl. She is like the opposite to that.
Is she wild?
She's feral. She is like Merida from Brave, like totally different. She's just totally different. And I just think, and it's nothing to do with me.
No.
And it's taught me so much, because I think the guilt initially, not just to do with his condition, but I think just, what should we be doing more? You know, should we be helping him more with speech and language? Should we have done more physio? And it's, that literally plays around in my head all day, every day. But then it just shows you, especially when you have another child, especially a neurotypical child that, you know, Annabelle seems to present to be. I think you just think, no matter what you do, obviously it's lovely to be able to parent them and do the right thing by them, but I'm just meeting her basic needs. She is just her own person, and it doesn't matter what we do. We will be told by her how she wants things to play out. So that's really taught me a lot. It's made me feel a lot more comforted, I think, because, and obviously as well, she's an amazing sibling for him, and she's fantastic. And I think having another sibling as well has really combated the loneliness. Not for him. He doesn't care. He'd happily be on his own. He's got no qualms. He just does his own thing. But things like soft play, activities that we plan, I love the fact that they're together and that she's a bit younger than him, and she supports him, but she also kind of meets him exactly where he's at, and they're just a great little team together. And it is amazing. It is.
That's so nice that she's kind of healed you in a way with those thoughts. I haven't heard somebody say that before, but that makes complete sense.
Yeah. She's really just taught me that you are, as much as you can meet their basic needs, and you can be a brilliant parent, you can do all this stuff, it, as you just described, it doesn't really direct you to that preferred future. It doesn't get you to that point. It is going to be where you end up because of them and their character and their likes and their dislikes. And she's so bossy, and she's so fierce, and she's absolutely crackers. And it's nothing that I've taught her, do you know what I mean? It's nothing that I've planned or said, right, this is how you're going to be. She just is who she is. And that's the same thing with Ted. You know, we couldn't now, you couldn't imagine him without cerebral palsy, because that is who he is. That's the way he says things, the tone that he has, the, you know, sometimes the attention he expects, you know, that is him. That's who he is. He can't believe that somebody wouldn't help him open his door. And, you know, sometimes he says, no, you could do that yourself. And he's like, oh. And it just has built his character. It's become who he is. So, yeah, it's amazing.
I think that's something that me and my husband, Ben, have spent time thinking about, or I certainly have, you know, that feeling of, would you take it away from them? Mm. Because if I took Leo's Down syndrome away, then he wouldn't be Leo. It's not, you know, he doesn't have, say, for example, a limb difference. You know, he has something that makes his brain and his body work in a different way to another child. And there are characteristics, lovely, lovely characteristics that he has that I know are because of the extra chromosome. And it's taken me a while to get to the point where I'm like, no, I wouldn't actually change it. And I used to hear people say that and I'm like, you're lying. Why are you saying that you wouldn't change it? Because that's clearly untrue. And I feel like probably 90% of me is at that place now. I'd change the way that the world sees him and the way that society looks at things. And there's some awful things that I've seen online recently, and I've mentioned this on another episode, I've got sucked into reading comments where I'm like, it's like I know I shouldn't, and I'm still like, oh my god, what are other people saying about this? And I'm like, Jesus, step away.
I'd heard it on another podcast, actually. Again, you know, the algorithm is sending me a lot of the send. I set up another Instagram for Ted, basically just on, you know, baby feeding and things, just to kind of get me through lockdown. But I follow a lot of send accounts online, and I think it can be really difficult. But I heard one, I'm sure you'll have seen it because it went viral. From the dad who wrote a letter to his autistic son.
I don't know if I have.
Oh, I'll have to get the I have to give you the name of it. It's a podcast. But he wrote a letter and he really sobbed throughout it, which made me feel better because I'm always crying about it whenever I talk about it. He really sobbed, and it was so beautifully written. But he put exactly that at the beginning. It's not you that I'm worried for or sorry for. It's the world that you're born into that I'm really worried about and really sorry about. And I think, you know, we are trying. There's so many amazing things now that are, you know, that are advancing. But it can be just so cruel sometimes. It can be really difficult that people might look, people might stare. Children ask questions, which is lovely, and that's absolutely fine. But yeah, it's more the environment and the worry for the future and their vulnerability that I really struggle with. Yeah. But I wouldn't change it now. I would absolutely change, as you said, I would change pain. I would change actually having to experience that from his own, you know, his own point of view. I'd change how hard things are for him compared to others. But I do also, again, think we're really lucky because a lot of the brain injuries that, you know, I've read into in the research is acquired brain injuries. But Ted doesn't know any different. It's how he feels. He's noticing now, and this is what's hard. He's noticing now the difference. He's noticing his hand doesn't turn in the same way as his sister's when they make bubbles. He notices certain things and he's like, why can't I do that? And I'm not as good at that. But he's also a really confident little boy. He's also really confident. He's really brave. And he likes doing his own thing. And I do feel like he's got the right attitude for his disability. I do. He's kind of just, yeah, I'm not that bothered. I won't do that. And I think we will face challenges as we get older. I remember Sally Phillips talked about her little boy who had Down. He's grown up now, I think. But one of her early podcasts that I listened to, she'd said about how each thing is another. She'd said, I think, that secondary school was an absolute car crash. And that helped a little bit because I remember thinking, oh, yeah, we think we've got it sorted with nursery. But actually, there's going to be all these different levels of new changes and new challenges for him and new environments, new people to accommodate him. And I've just seen actually today, it's really interesting that she's posted that her son's got into drama school or something.
Yeah, I saw it. But she mentioned in that post, didn't she, how hard the education system was for them. And I thought it was really nice, actually, because she If you haven't seen it, if you're listening, she posted lovely pictures of him in the garden, I think, wasn't it? Just saying, oh, you know, congratulations to Ollie, he's off to drama school, and, you know, thanking the people that had helped him get there. But I thought it was really nice that she kind of underneath that kind of acknowledged, you know, if you're going through this school system and you're finding it really hard with your local authority, kind of like, I feel you, we've been there, I hope it gets better for you. I thought that was really nice. Yeah.
And but conversely as well, I do also feel really lucky about from the amount of support that we've got for Ted. You know, so really sometimes, as you've said, you see the file and you do think like, my God, there's so many people that know him and there's so many people that work with him and have as part of their diary to go and see him in school and check the setting is okay. They're going to get him a particular chair. They're going to go and check the outdoor space and make sure that it's safe, and they've done that twice already. And I do feel, you know, I feel really fortunate that we've got that. We recently had a visit to the RVI in Newcastle. I said, we are so lucky to have this. We've got a team. We walked into this room and we had a team of people that are there just to look at how he's walking and just to look at, right, the filming him and making sure that they're noticing everything. And I did come away thinking, you know, yeah, I suppose we are just so fortunate to live in this society, because I know we can whinge a lot and we've got a lot of things to fight against, but at the same time, there are people that are there to help.
Speaking of support, though, but different kind of support, you mentioned earlier on that you found it really difficult at the beginning to find like peer support. Has that changed? Have you managed to find people who are in the same situation as you?
I would say probably not. But I think over time, things get a little bit easier in that I don't feel like I need it as much anymore. I think initially it's a little bit like starting somewhere new, isn't it? You immediately try to find people that are in the same boat or try to find people you know. And I do think it is extremely lonely, because you do just kind of want to have that chat with someone about, I don't know, you know, you want to have a whinge maybe, or you want someone to understand completely. And I don't think anyone really gets it. I don't, unless you have gone through exactly the same thing. Even, you know, even me and you, we won't get each other's experiences because it's not the same. And I remember, as I said, I remember joining that charity and thinking, oh, other people will get this. And I couldn't identify. I just couldn't. It was totally different. We joined a swimming group for children with disabilities. And again, it felt probably even more isolating, to be honest, because I thought everyone's got their own thing going on, of course. Everyone's got their own problems. But everyone was so different from what I was doing. And I wanted to find someone who was exactly the same. And I think that's tough. I think for peer support and for kind of that community feel, I do think like social media has been amazing, because you can follow those accounts of people that, yes, they're not, you know, they're not round the corner, but they really are kind of almost exactly the same situation. I managed to find a little girl who was exactly the same age, who was going through the same thing. And I was warned about social media initially, because it can be, again, quite a dangerous place, as you've said. It can be difficult when you're comparing yourselves. But we have joined Contact as a charity, have a hemiplegia group as well for children who specifically experience that. And that's really useful as a forum. So people put on things, for example, about how to combat shoe issues with splints. How do you manage, you know, certain things like, you know, how would you manage swimming and how do you manage X, Y, and Z? And one thing in particular keeps coming up about bikes. It's like, how do we help them? How do we combat not being able to ride a bike? So people are recommending different things that they use. And that's been really useful because, again, they're dealing with the same condition specifically. But it's rare. So you don't, you know, you haven't got someone around the corner who's going through it. And I do find it hard with my friends because, as I said, like, as much as they want to support, they don't get it. And I think, you know, people say, oh, let's do this, let's do that. Well, I have to make sure that's right for him, and I have to go through that. And part of it is an anxiety, I think, that I've built up myself as a parent, not wanting him to feel inadequate or not able to do something. So I think I put up the defence barriers a little bit first. And that can be hard. It can be hard on my friends as well. And I did initially have a bit of a pushback time where I was a bit like, nope, nope, nope. And we joke about it now because I've got some amazing friends and they've just not gone anywhere, even though I'd said no, no, no. And we laugh and say, there's only so many times you can say no before people give up, but not giving up, you know. And we're still friends because we're friends and it's not us about being mum friends. But I do think my mum friends that I originally made, I found that particularly hard. Because you're all starting at the same point and then something else has come in to, yeah, knock us sideways, essentially. And it can be, yeah, it can be really lonely. Yeah.
Do you struggle with comparison with your other mum friends?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think, and they say, don't they, like, comparison is the thief of joy. They say that. But you just weirdly can't help it. Like, it's a weird thing, isn't it? I don't know where it comes from. I don't know why. And I do think we've got 10 times better than where we were. Because, yeah, you can't let it. I've essentially, as you've said, over hours of therapy and trying to work through it, I don't need to compare him. I don't want to compare. And again, Annabelle's taught me a lot that it's not really about parenting. I think with your first, it's like, ooh, did y'all sleep through? And ooh, can y'all do this? With your second, you're basically just trying to get through the day. Just, you know, dressed and okay. And I think that kind of comes with the territory, which is really good. I just think experience teaches you a lot. Yeah. I don't need to compare, but I think that's helped combat loneliness eventually, because I've not felt the need to meet people. I've got some amazing friends who are my friends. I don't need to find more mum friends. Yeah. But again, there's more. There's another barrier. So we've met some really nice nursery mum friends, which has been lovely, and they're so inclusive and they've just been amazing. And Ted is just one of the gang, and they've never even mentioned it, you know. Part of me sometimes think some of them even know, because they just wouldn't. But I do think now we've got this new level of school, and what's that going to look like? And are we going to meet people that are inclusive and kind? And it can be tough. I remember one really embarrassing time where I went out with some baby mum friends that I'd met at a baby sensory class, and we'd gone out for drinks and someone had mentioned something they were worried about, and I was a bit like, oh yeah, yeah, and I was trying to be supportive, but I'd maybe had, you know, one or two gins, and ended up then telling them what I was worried about and just sobbing. And I remember, you know, just the change in, you know, we were just in like a pub somewhere, and I remember them all just being a bit like, and someone went, oh, shall I go and get you another drink? And I thought, for God's sake, you're trying to make friends here and you've just made them think you're an absolute psycho. And that's just where I was. That's just where I was at the time. I was barely sleeping. I was just worried all the time. I was anxious and I was desperately trying to make friends, and I didn't really need to. I was just trying to go, oh, is there anyone else who's in this boat? Yeah. And it probably just took up a bit too much of my energy. And I think really I should have just stripped it back and just took the pressure off us. And I said to a friend this summer, I said, I've taken the pressure off. I don't feel like we have to be out doing these amazing summer holiday days, because that always gets to me and I feel guilty. But actually, we've just done exactly what we wanted to do, because they're a little team. We've just done what we wanted. We've met a few people along the way, but it's been brilliant. And it's been brilliant for all of us, because my mental health was better. I wasn't feeling like we were trying to do too much. And they've had a great time. They've had a brilliant time.
You saying about the connection on social media, I completely agree. It's amazing for that. And that was the first place that I looked when I felt able to reach out to people and wanted to find some kind of support. But I think the flip side of it is seeing, and I think the holidays are awful for it. Halloween is awful for it, and Christmas is awful for it. You feel like you aren't matching up to what other parents are doing. Not anything to do with any kind of disability or additional need, but I find that really difficult. You go, oh my God, they've gone to the beach and they've had a lovely picnic and they've spent the whole day there, and they're the parents that have got the windbreakers there and all the toys, and the kids have paddled in the sea, and then they've gone for dinner somewhere nice. And I was like, I've forgotten all the toys and we haven't got the windbreaker, and then sand went in the sandwiches, and then I had a meltdown because of the food. And I think those things are hard. And I think it's great to hear you say that you just went, oh, well, just do what we want. And you do have a nicer time.
You do. You do. When you're not having to meet people, you're not having, you don't have that pressure, do you? And especially when, as I said, there's things that we have to think about in addition. And yeah. I sometimes think, and you don't, and I get, you know, I get anxiety over if we're going to meet people. What's he going to be like? Is he going to be shattered? Am I going to have to go early? It's stuff like that where I think, oh, I don't want the pressure of it. I would rather not. And I just say to my friends now, I'd rather meet. Can we just meet without the kids? And they love my kids. It's not like they don't want to include them. They really do. But I think it's harder for me. It's harder as a parent to try and do both because I think my parenting is not typical. And that's what I've realised now. The laugh, you know, my sister and sister-in-law recently, we were at a soft play and I turned around and I said, oh, is this what you do? They both kind of sat down with their coffee.
Oh, were they sitting with a coffee? Yeah.
I was like, oh. And they were like, yeah, of course. And they were, you know, in a nice way. And again, I even maybe used it as an excuse, but I said, well, I've got a two-year-old in there as well. And I was a little bit, not defensive, but thinking, I've got that as an excuse. Really, I think I will be always watching Ted. I think I will, because that's who I am. Like I said, I can't let him just keep falling down this volcano on his own without some encouragement. Come on, come on. That will always be me. And it's acceptance, isn't it, of he's going to have me as his cheerleader the whole time. I won't be that one who can sit and relax, but that's okay. We can still join in. I've made my peace with it now.
Yeah.
And I've bought myself a big trolley for the beach. So, you know, if he gets shattered, there's a trolley. It's just the certain things that I've just learned to go, right, we'll do that, we'll do this. And it's okay, yeah.
So I finish the podcast in the same way each time with the same two questions. The first being, what is the best piece of advice you've been given along the way?
I'd say, I think with advice, the main one initially from our consultant when she first said about the diagnosis is she'd said to stay off social media. She said, stay off Google and stay off social media because they are not an accurate representation of your life and what is going on in front of you. And I think, even though I think social media has been great eventually for me to have a bit more of a community, to get help with certain things, I think in those early days, it was absolutely brilliant advice because I was looking for answers really that weren't there and it was very, very dark and difficult. So I think that's really good advice. I think that comparison part, especially on social media, just is not healthy for you when you're processing something so early on. I think that was brilliant advice and we kind of heeded that initially. And as I said, once you've got your confidence and you know what you're dealing with, then it's easier to be able to combat the darker side of social media, I think.
And then what do you wish you'd known when you got Ted's diagnosis that you know now?
Oh, I feel like this is a bit of a cliche because people have said this on your podcast before. But I think the answer to it is just that everything will be all right. And I think it's really difficult, isn't it, in those darker days when you are thinking, what on earth? And I do genuinely remember saying to my sister that we wouldn't be able to move to like a village location because Ted will be wheelchair bound. And I think we were maybe 2 days in to the diagnosis. And she just said, oh, okay, no problem. And at the time thought, oh God, you know, what is happening? But I'd just gone from 0 to 100. I was planning all sorts of things. I was thinking, just thinking the worst. But I think what I regret then is losing the time, you know, so early on, losing a lot of time to depression, anxiety, to fear of the unknown. And it's a few people have said this, haven't they? You wish you kind of had that crystal ball of being able to see him in his uniform the last two days and being absolutely fine coming out of school today and telling me all about it. But you just don't know, do you? But I do wish I'd had exactly the same scenario to kind of be able to follow and say, right, this is what it's going to be like. But you just don't, do you? You just don't have someone who has the map or has the guidelines of how to be a send parent and do it well. And I think for me, particularly, I'd say another thing is work. I think work has been brilliant for me because There's many times when I've thought, I don't think I can do this. I can't be a carer and, you know, parent and work full time. But it's been actually, even though I didn't think it would be, it's been a massive string to my bow, working in education and being able to identify with parents and say to people, I get you, I know what you're dealing with, I understand, and have you tried this and have you thought about this? And I've even started a parent forum at work because I know how lonely it is and I just want them to know there's someone who has had a morning like them that, you know, has struggled in the same way, because, yeah, it's really difficult, really difficult.
That's so nice that you've done that. Laura, thank you so much for chatting to me. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me.
I always feel like I press stop too quickly because I press stop on the episode and then me and Laura carried on having a lovely chat. To be honest, though, if I didn't press stop when I do, these episodes would be like 3 hours long, because if you haven't guessed already, I can talk and talk and talk, and I love it when my guests are the same as well. I really hope you enjoyed that episode. I love chatting to Laura, and like I said at the beginning, I loved that she slid into my DMs, because it's not just something I say. You know, I'm obviously getting recommendations for people to come on the podcast and tell their story, and I find a lot of people on social media as well, and I slide into their DMs, but I'm constantly on the lookout for guests. I'm constantly on the lookout for people to share their stories and, you know, the things that they've gone through, and the hope that it can help other people. So please, once again, if you would love to come on the podcast and share your story, or maybe you know somebody, maybe you've got a family member or a friend who you think, oh my God, they need to come on and talk about their son or their daughter and, the, you know, the experiences and the journey that they've gone on, then the Instagram is at the Send Mum Club. That's the easiest way to get in touch with me. You can slide into my DMs. There is also an email link if you'd prefer to email. But yeah, please keep the suggestions and the requests coming in. And as always, I'd love to know what you'd love to hear more of or less of. You know, I'm open to the constructive criticism. I'm not. That's a lie. Don't say mean things. Right. That is the end of another episode. I will be back same time next week with another fabulous guest for you. And as always, if you could take the time, if you're not already, to like follow, subscribe, rate, review, all of those nice things, it just helps more people to find the podcast. And I will see you back here next week.